Point Pleasant, 11 miles below. Within 10 days, 4 days before the Navy's tardy arrival, he had captured both places, along with 25 heavy guns and quantities of equipment and supplies, when the defenders retreated to the security of the East Bank and the fastness of Island 10. He would have taken that place, too. He knew exactly how to go about it, except that he could not effect a crossing without protection for his transports. Confederate batteries commanded the river from the opposite bank, and even worse, there was a motley collection of makeshift rebel gunboats on patrol. Neither of these deterrents would be much of a problem for even a single ironclad, Pope declared, if Foote would only send it. But this the naval commander would not do. Any attempt to run the gauntlet of the island batteries, he replied, would result in the sacrifice of the boat, her officers, and men, which sacrifice I would not be justified in making. Pope was more vexed than discouraged. A week after his capture of New Madrid, in recognition of his hard-hitting competence, he had been made a major general. He would keep up the pressure, hoping in time to stiffen the Navy's backbone. Meanwhile, he had the rebels in a cul-de-sac, backed up against the swamps that lay between Real Foote Lake and the river. There was no way out for them and no way in for supplies, except along the road leading south through Tiptonville. Once the Federals were astride the river, the road would be cut. He could bag the lot by quick assault or, at the worst, by siege. All he wanted was a chance to ferry his men across with a fair degree of safety. Suspecting that the Navy would never get up nerve enough to run past Island 10, he began to construct a Navy of his own. High-sided barges armored with boilerplate, designed to accommodate field guns. He kept busy in other ways as well, manning the captured heavy guns to strengthen his domination of Madrid Bend and bringing down supplies and reinforcements from upriver. This last took ingenuity, for the right bank swamps blocked the direct route, but the general had that too. He had his engineers cut a channel, a canal it was called, 50 feet wide, 9 miles long, and 4.5 feet deep, this being the depth at which the flooded trees were sawed off underwater, connecting the river 5 miles north of the gunboat station with Wilson's Bayou, which gave down upon New Madrid, thus bypassing the bend commanded by the guns on Island 10. Shallow draft transports got through with another whole division, bringing Pope's total strength to 23,000, but not the gunboats whose bottoms would have been torn out by the stumps. Their only way led down past the cannon-bristled island, which Foote believed would sink in short order whatever came within range. All but one of the gunboat captains agreed with the flag officer's estimate as to the outcome of a downstream fight or a try at running the batteries. That one was Commander Henry Walk, skipper of the Carondelet. For 2 weeks now, the diurnal mortar bombardment had continued, and except for a single boat expedition, which spiked some guns in an abandoned battery on All Fools' Night, all that had been accomplished by the Navy was a heavy expenditure of ammunition. A 54-year-old Virginia-born Ohioan and a veteran of all the river engagements from Belmont on, Walk was touched in his pride, and had been so ever since Donelson, when, as last boat out of the fight, he had retreated, firing blindly in an attempt to hide in the gun smoke. It was his belief that the run could be made with a good chance of success, provided it was made in silence and by the dark of the moon. If the rebels did not know he was there, they would not shoot. Or if they knew he was there, but could not see him, they would not be likely to hit him. At any rate, he was willing to give it a try, and he said so at a conference on the flagship in late March. Foote was pleased to hear that someone thought the run could be made, though he himself was doubtful. The army jibes had begun to sting, and there were reports that the Confederates were building a fleet of giant ironclads at Memphis. He might soon have a downstream fight on his hands against much longer odds, whether he wanted it or not. He asked Walk if he would be willing to back up his opinion by trying the run in the Carondelet. Walk said he would, emphatically. Foote said, "All right, go ahead." He would not order a man to try what he himself had already said was too risky, but he would approve it on a volunteer basis. Walk began his preparations at once. The moon would be new and early down on the night of April 4th, which left him just under a week for getting ready. During this time, he piled his decks with planks from a wrecked barge to give protection from plunging shot, coiled surplus chain in vulnerable spots, and wound an 11-inch hawser round and round the pilot house as high up as the windows. Cordwood barriers were built to enclose the boilers, and a coal barge loaded with bales of hay was lashed to the port side, which caused an observer to remark that the gunboat resembled a farmer's wagon prepared for market. The only light she carried would be a lantern in the engine room, invisible from outside, and to ensure silence the engines were muffled by piping the escape steam through the paddle wheel housing instead of through the stacks as usual. The one thing Walk was to avoid beyond all others was being captured. Fighting upstream in rebel hands, the Carondelet might be a match for all her sister ships combined. To guard against this, the crew was armed with cutlasses, pistols, and hand grenades. 2 dozen volunteer sharpshooters were taken aboard. Hot water hoses were connected to the boilers for the purpose of scalding boarders. And if all else failed, Walk's orders were that she was to be sunk beneath their feet. Through the early evening of April 4th, the sickle moon shone brightly, if intermittently, over and under a scud of black clouds racing past. Then came moonset, 10 o'clock. Walk passed the word, "Already," and the gunboat slipped her moorings. The muffled engines merely throbbed. The gathering clouds had masked the stars. So absolute were the darkness and the silence as the Carondelet stood out for New Madrid, the officers on deck asked through the speaking pipes if the engineer was going ahead on her. It was not so for long. Just as she cleared the line of mortar rafts at the head of the moored column, the storm broke with tropical fury. Vast and vivid streaks of lightning split the sky, so that to one who watched it was as if the gates of hell were opened and shut every instant, suffering the whole fierce reflection of the infernal lake to flash across the sky. Thunder crashed and rumbled, and the rain came down in gulfs. The river ahead was an illuminated highway, with Island 10 looming in ominous silhouette, its drowsy lookouts no doubt startled into wide-eyed action at seeing the Yankee gunboat bearing down on them like something on a brightly lighted stage. Yet apparently not. Walk held his course past the first battery without being fired on, when suddenly, of her own accord, the Carondelet signaled her presence to her enemies ashore. Dry soot in her chimneys, normally kept wet by the escape steam, took fire and shot 5-foot torches from their crowns, bathing with a yellow glare the upper deck and everything around. That did it. Ashore, there were cries of alarm and an officer shouting, "Elevate! Elevate!" And then the crash of gunfire through the thunder. Carondelet went with the current, a leadsman knee-deep in muddy foam on her bow to sing out the soundings. The coal barge lashed alongside impeded her speed, but was no less welcome for that, coming as it did between the batteries and their target. Shells shrieked overhead or were heard plunging into the water as the island guns were echoed by others along the Tennessee bank. Wallowing in the wind-whipped waves, still under the crash and flash of thunder and lightning, the little ironclad held her course and took no hits. Clear of the island, she still had the floating battery to pass, but the final 6 shots from there were misses, like the rest. She had made it. Pulling up to the New Madrid landing, where Army cannoneers were giving the Navy its due at last by tossing their caps and cheering, Walk proudly took up a speaking trumpet and announced his arrival to those on bank, then turned to his bosun's mate and authorized the sounding of Grago. Against regulations, the main brace then was spliced. Pope at last had what he had been saying was all he needed, a gunboat south of Island 10, and presently he had 2. Learning of the Carondelet's successful run, She had taken two hits after all, it turned out, one in the coal barge, one in a bale of hay. Foote sent the Pittsburgh down to repeat the performance on the night of the 6th, which was also dark and stormy. The makeshift rebel flotilla scattered, awed, and the ironclads knocked out the batteries opposite Point Pleasant. Pope put his men on transports and had the gunboats herd them over. The Tiptonville Road was cut within an hour of the unopposed landing. All he had to do then was put his hand out. The 7,000 Confederates were in it, along with more than 100 pieces of light and heavy artillery, 7,000 small arms, horses and mules by droves, mounds of equipment including tents for 12,000 men, and several boatloads of provisions. It was all over before the dawn of April 8th, accomplished without the loss of a single man in combat. The North had another hero, Bluff John Pope. A forthright combination of ingenuity and drive, large-bodied, with stolid eyes and a full beard that spread down over his upper chest, his broad, flat face framed by dark brown hair brushed straight back from the bulging expanse of forehead and falling long at the sides, he commanded confidence by his very presence. Once he saw what he wanted, he went after it on his own, unflinchingly. The military worth of such a man was clear for all to see, including his commander. Halleck wired, exuberant, "I congratulate you and your command on your splendid achievement. It excels in boldness and brilliancy all other operations of the war. It will be memorable in military history and will be admired by future generations. You deserve well of your country." Thus Halleck rejoiced and Pope basked in well-earned laudation, while their opponent Beauregard experienced quite opposite emotions. Once more on the eve of scoring what he had hoped would be a beautiful 10-strike, he was suddenly faced instead with the imminent testing of his prediction that the fall of New Madrid and Island 10 would mean the immediate loss of the whole Mississippi Valley. For him, this meant the loss of the war, and he was correspondingly cast down. Midway of the campaign, which was stretching his nerves to the breaking point, one fluke of his left flank anchor had snapped and the other seemed about to snap as well. He wrote to a friend in Congress, inquiring distractedly, "Will not heaven open the eyes and senses of our rulers? Where in the world are we going to, if not to destruction?" 2. Good news was doubly welcome in St. Louis, where Halleck had sat desk-bound all this time, scratching his elbows and addressing his goggle-eyed stare in the general direction of the back-area correspondents, who came clamoring for information he could not give because he did not have it. The month between the mid-February capture of Fort Donelson and the mid-March fall of New Madrid had been for him a time of strain, one in which he saw his probable advancement placed in precarious balance opposite his probable stagnation. He had come out top man in the end, but the events leading up to that happy termination, as if, perversely, the fates had established a sort of inverse ratio between the success of federal arms and the rise of Henry Halleck, had contained for him far more of anguish than of joy. There was small consolation in realizing later that the fates had been with him all along, that the cause for all that anguish had existed only in his own mind, as a product of fear and suspicion. His first reaction, the day after the fall of the Cumberland Fortress, was to request promotions for Buell, Grant, and C.F. Smith, and advancement for himself. "Give me command of the West," he wired McClellan. "I ask this in return for Forts Henry and Donelson." His second reaction, following hard on the heels of the first, was fear that Grant's victory might sting the Confederates into desperation. Even now, perhaps, they were massing for a sudden all-or-nothing lunge, northward around Grant's flank. Beauregard's plan for an attack on Paducah and Cairo had not gone beyond the dream stage, but Halleck feared it quite literally, and called urgently for Buell to come help him. Buell replied in effect that he had troubles of his own, and Halleck was even more firmly convinced of the necessity for authority to bend him to his will. "I must have command of the armies of the West," he told McClellan in a second wire, sent 3 days after the first, which had gone unanswered. "Hesitation and delay are losing us the golden opportunity. Lay this before the President and the Secretary of War. May I assume command? Answer quickly." This time McClellan did answer quickly, but not as his fretful subordinate had hoped, replying that he believed Buell could handle his own army better from Bowling Green than Halleck could do from St. Louis. He declined to lay old Brains's self-recommendation on the presidential desk. Perhaps it was what Halleck had expected. At any rate, he had already put a second string to his bow, forwarding for Stanton's out-of-channels approval a plan for reorganizing the Western Department under his command. February 21st, the day after McClellan's refusal, Stanton replied that he liked the plan, but on account of the domestic affliction of the president — Willie Lincoln had died the day before and was lying in state in the White House — "I have not yet been able to submit it to him." Halleck's hopes took a bound at this. Determined to strike while the iron was hot, he wired back that same day, urging the one-over secretary to break in on the president's family trouble, whatever it was. "One whole week has been lost already by hesitation and delay," he complained. "There was, and I think there still is, a golden opportunity to strike a fatal blow, but I can't do it unless I can control Buell's army. There is not a moment to be lost. Give me the authority, and I will be responsible for results." Stanton's reply came the following day, and Halleck's hopes hit bottom with a thud. The secretary had gotten to Lincoln, but after full consideration of the subject, he telegraphed, "The president does not think any change in the organization of the army or the military departments at present advisable." Halleck's bow was completely unstrung. There was no one left to appeal to, either in or out of channels. After 2 days spent absorbing the shock, he replied with what grace he could muster. "If it is thought that the present arrangement is best for the public service, I have nothing to say. I have done my duty in making the suggestions, and I leave it to my superiors to adopt or reject them." For others closer at hand, however, he either had less grace to spare or else it was exhausted. Encountering signs of paperwork confusion down at Cairo that same day, he testily informed his chief of staff, "There is a screw loose in that command. It had better be fixed pretty soon, or the command will hear from me." That was still his irascible, sore-pawed frame of mind the following week, when his worst fears in regard to Grant appeared to have been realized. At a time when Halleck was most concerned about a possible rebel counterattack, launched with all the fury of desperation, Grant and his 30,000 soldiers, the combat-hardened core of any defense the department commander might have to make, lost touch with headquarters, apparently neglecting to file reports because he was off on a double celebration of victory and promotion. The former alcoholic captain was now a major general, 10th-ranking man in the whole U.S. Army. Lincoln had signed the recommendation on the night of the day the Donelson news reached Washington, and the Senate had promptly confirmed it as of the unconditional surrender date. Halleck himself had urged the promotion, but not as warmly as he had urged several others, and he had yet to congratulate Grant personally for the capture of the forts. Other promotions were in the mill, soon to be acted on. Buell and Pope were to be major generals within a week, along with others, including Smith, but Grant would outrank them, which was not at all what Halleck had intended or expected. The fact was, absorbed as he had been in his rivalry with Buell, he was beginning to see that he had raised an even more formidable hero opponent right there in his own front yard. Donelson, having caught the public fancy — the public, in its short-sighted way, was giving all the credit to the general on the scene, rather than to the commander who had masterminded the campaign from St. Louis. Irked by this, he then was confronted with what he considered the crowning instance of Grant's instability. Having won his promotion, the new hero apparently thought himself above the necessity for filing reports as to his whereabouts or condition. Where he was now, Halleck did not know for sure, but there were rumors. On March 3rd, McClellan received a dispatch indicating that Halleck's sorely tried patience had at last snapped. "I have had no communication with General Grant for more than a week. He left his command without my authority and went to Nashville. His army seems to be as much demoralized by the victory of Fort Donelson as was that of the Potomac by the defeat of Bull Run. It is hard to censure a successful general immediately after a victory, but I think he richly deserves it. I can get no returns, no reports, no information of any kind from him. Satisfied with his victory, he sits down and enjoys it without any regard to the future. I'm worn out and tired with this neglect and inefficiency." McClellan, whose eye for a possible rival was quite as sharp as Halleck's own, was sudden in reply. "Generals must observe discipline as well as private soldiers. Do not hesitate to arrest him at once if the good of the service requires it. You are at liberty to regard this as a positive order if it will smooth your way." Halleck did not hesitate. The order went by wire to Grant at once. "You will place Brigadier General C.F. Smith in command of expedition and remain yourself at Fort Henry. Why do you not obey my orders to report strength and positions of your command?" The question was largely rhetorical. Halleck believed he already knew the answer, and he gave it in a telegram informing McClellan of his action in the matter. "A rumor has just reached me that since the taking of Fort Donelson, General Grant has resumed his former bad habits. If so, it will account for his neglect of my often repeated orders." To anyone with an ear for army gossip, and McClellan's was highly tuned in that respect, this meant that Grant was off on a bender. "I do not deem it advisable to arrest him at present," Halleck continued, "but have placed General Smith in command of the expedition up the Tennessee. I think Smith will restore order and discipline." Grant had been guilty of none of these things, and he said so in a telegram to Halleck as soon as he had complied with the instructions to turn over his command. "I am not aware of ever having disobeyed any order from headquarters. Certainly never intended such a thing." The communications hiatus was explained by the defection of a telegraph operator who took Grant's dispatches with him, unsent, when he deserted. It was true, Grant said, that he had been to Nashville, but that was because Halleck had told him nothing. He had gone there to meet Buell and work out a plan for cooperation. When Halleck still showed resentment at having been left in the dark, Grant observed that there must be enemies between them and asked to be relieved from further duty in the department. Halleck refused to agree to this, but continued to bolster his case by forwarding an anonymous letter charging that the property captured at Fort Henry had been questionably handled. His dander really up now, Grant replied. "There is such a disposition to find fault with me that I again ask to be relieved from further duty until I can be placed right in the estimation of those higher in authority." Suddenly, incredibly, all was sweetness and light at Halleck's end of the wire. "You cannot be relieved from your command," he answered. "There is no good reason for it. Instead of relieving you, I wish you, as soon as your new army is in the field, to assume command and lead it on to new victories." There were a number of reasons behind this sudden change in attitude and disposition, all of which had occurred between the leveling and the withdrawing of the charges against Grant. First, the evacuation of Columbus had relieved Halleck's fears that the Confederates were about to unleash an attack on Cairo or Paducah. And while Curtis was stopping Van Dorn at Elkhorn Tavern, Pope was applying a bear hug on New Madrid. Then, just as he was congratulating himself on these improvements in the tactical situation, a stiff letter came from the adjutant general demanding specifications for the vague charges he had been making against his new major general. Trial by rumor would not do, the army's head lawyer informed him. "By direction of the president, the secretary of war desires you to ascertain and report whether General Grant left his command at any time without proper authority. And if so, for how long, whether he has made to you proper reports and returns of his force, whether he has committed any acts which are unauthorized or not in accordance with military subordination or propriety, And if so, what? To reply as directed would be to give Grant what he had been seeking, a chance to be placed right in the estimation of those higher in authority. Besides, Halleck had no specifications to report, only rumors. Instead, he replied that he was satisfied Grant had acted from a praiseworthy although mistaken zeal. I respectfully recommend that no further notice be taken of it. All these irregularities have now been remedied. However, there was something more behind this sudden volte-face, this willingness to bury the hatchet he had been flourishing lately. March 11th, the day after the adjutant general's call for specifics, and 2 days before he blandly informed Grant that there was no good reason for relieving him, the fond hope for which he had labored in and out of channels all these months was realized. He got the West. His command, which was called the Department of the Mississippi, and extended for better than 500 miles eastward, from Kansas to a north-south line through Knoxville, was awarded him by Lincoln in the same war order that deposed McClellan as general-in-chief and recalled Fremont to active duty. Receiving it that way out of the blue after 2 solid weeks of despair, Halleck was in no mood to quarrel with anyone, not even Grant. In fact, especially not Grant. Beauregard was reported to be entrenching around Corinth, reinforced to a strength of 20,000 men. "If so, he will make a Manassas of it," Halleck said. That meant hard fighting, in which case he wanted his hardest-fighting general in command, and that meant Grant, whatever his instability in other respects. "The power is in your hands," Halleck told him. "Use it, and you will be sustained by all above you." So Grant got aboard a steamboat at Fort Henry and went up the Tennessee to rejoin his army. Beauregard was at Corinth, and he had been reinforced. Halleck's information was true as far as it went. But the Creole was not planning a Manassas. He was planning a Caney, or at least an Austerlitz, and for once, though he did not neglect the accustomed flourish at the outset, "Soldiers, I assume this day the command of the Army of the Mississippi for the defense of our homes and liberties, and to resist the subjugation, spoliation, and dishonor of our people. Our mothers and wives, our sisters and children, expect us to do our duty even to the sacrifice of our lives. Our cause is as just and sacred as ever animated men to take up arms, and if we are true to it and to ourselves, with the continued protection of the Almighty, we must and shall triumph." His dream was built on something more than rhetoric and hope. Recent and looming disasters at last had jarred the Richmond government into action. The fall of Henry and Donelson, followed at once by the loss of Kentucky and Middle Tennessee, now threatened the railroad leading eastward from Memphis, through Corinth and Tuscumbia, to Chattanooga, where it branched south, through Atlanta, to Charleston and Savannah, and north, through Knoxville, to Lynchburg and Richmond. The vertebrae of the Confederacy, former War Secretary L.P. Walker called it, and rightly, for once this only east-west all-weather supply line was cut, the Upper South would be divided, as prone for conquest as a man with a broken backbone. Now, when Beauregard cried wolf, as he had done unheeded so often before, the authorities listened. Without Major General Braxton Bragg and the 10,000 soldiers he commanded at Mobile and Pensacola, the southern coast would be wide open to amphibious attack, but under the press of necessity, the dispersed defensive was out, no matter the risk. Bragg and his men were ordered north to Corinth. So were Brigadier General Daniel Ruggles and his 5,000 from New Orleans, though their departure left the South's chief city without infantry to defend it. By early March they were with Beauregard, absorbed into the Army of the Mississippi. Combined with Polk's 10,000, so that in point of fact it was they who did the absorbing, they brought the expansive Creole's total strength to 25,000 men. His spirits were lifted toward elation by this considerable transfusion of troops from his native shore, including one elite New Orleans outfit which carried his name on its roster as an honorary private. P. "Pierre-Gustave Touton Beauregard," rang out daily at roll call, like the sudden unfurling of a silken banner. "Absent on duty," the color sergeant proudly answered for him. He looked forward to combinations and maneuvers that would be nothing less than Napoleonic in concept and execution. Johnston, by now, was across the Tennessee, marching westward from Decatur with the remnant of what had been the Army of Kentucky. Floyd's brigade had been sent to Chattanooga, but Forrest's troopers had caught up with the column, bringing Hardee's total to 15,000. When they arrived, there would be 40,000 soldiers around Corinth, exactly the number the impatiently waiting general had said would allow a strike at Cairo and Paducah. Nor was that all. Van Dorn's 15,000, licking their Elkhorn Tavern wounds in Arkansas, had been alerted for an eastward march that would bring them across the Mississippi at Memphis, where they would find boxcars waiting to bring them rapidly down the vital railroad line to Corinth. The total then would soar to 55,000. Any twinge of regret for the 20,000 lost at Donelson and penned up now on Island 10 was quickly assuaged by the thought that even without them, the Army of the Mississippi would not only be the largest any Confederate had ever commanded, but in fact would be almost twice as large as the combined force that had covered itself and its generals, particularly Beauregard, with glory at Manassas. As he waited now for Johnston, he rehearsed in his mind the recommendations he would make for the utilization of this strength. Scouts had been bringing him full reports of the enemy situation all this time. Grant's army was 20-odd miles to the north, in camp on the left bank of the Tennessee, awaiting the arrival of Buell's army, which was moving west from Nashville. Even with the addition of Van Dorn and Johnston, the southern army would not be as large as the two northern armies combined, but it would be larger than either on its own. The answer, then, provided the gray-clad reinforcements won the race, which seemed likely since the Yankees marching overland from Nashville were encountering various obstacles, such as burned bridges, was a slashing attack. If Van Dorn and Johnston reached Corinth before Buell reached the Tennessee, the superior Confederate army would pounce on Grant and accomplish his destruction, then fall in turn on Buell and treat him likewise, after which the way to Louisville and St. Louis would lie open. Beauregard saw and rehearsed it thus in his mind, complete no doubt with the final surrender ceremonies at the point of deepest penetration, wherever that might be. When Johnston arrived on the 24th at the head of the column which now reached the end of its long retreat from Bowling Green, he considered the race half won. The tall, handsome Texan, who had set out 7 months ago, buoyed up by the confident hopes of the South that he would drive the blue invaders from the soil of his native Kentucky, now came back to Mississippi oppressed by the seething resentment of those who had cheered him loudest then. He took it calmly, the flared mustache and deep-set eyes masking whatever hurt the barbs of criticism gave him. "What the people want is a victory," he had said, and he welcomed Beauregard's proposal, the more so since it coincided with plans he had made on the march, as a chance to give them one. In fact, as a sign of appreciation for all the Louisiana general had done in the trying past few weeks, Johnston made the gesture of offering him command of the army for the coming battle. He himself would act as department commander, he said, with headquarters at Memphis or at nearby Holly Springs. Beauregard's heart gave a leap at this, touching his fiery ambition as it did, but he recognized a gesture when he saw one and declined. Then the two got down to preparing the army for combat, prescribing rigid training schedules for the soldiers, who, being raw, needed all the instruction they could possibly absorb, and reorganizing them into four corps, 10,000 under Polk, 16,000 under Bragg, 7,000 under Hardee, and 7,000 under Breckinridge. The last was designated as Crittenden's at first, but he was presently removed to suffer demotion for the Fishing Creek debacle. The 15,000 under Van Dorn would add a substantial Fifth Corps when they got there, but even without them, the army was about as large as the one Grant had in camp on the near bank of the Tennessee, 22 miles to the north. The reinstated federal commander had been with his army a week by the time Johnston joined Beauregard at Corinth. After the 100-mile boat ride, Grant came ashore at Savannah, a hamlet on the east bank, where C.F. Smith, an old soldier who never neglected the creature comforts, had established headquarters in a fine private mansion overlooking a bend of the Tennessee. One division was at Crump's Landing, 3 miles upstream on the opposite bank, and as Grant arrived, the other five were debarking at Pittsburgh Landing, 6 miles farther south, and also on the west side of the river. The site had been recommended by the commander of one of the new divisions. A magnificent plain for camping and drilling, he called it, and a military point of great strength. This was Tecumseh Sherman. He too had been reinstated, Halleck having decided that he was not really insane after all, just high-strung and talkative. Besides, he had a brother in the Senate. Grant, for one, thought highly of him. During the Donelson campaign, Sherman had worked hard, forwarding reinforcements and supplies and offering to waive his then-superior rank for a chance to come up and join the fighting. But the men assigned to him were not so sure, not at the outset anyhow. Red-headed and gaunt, with sunken temples and a grizzled, short-cropped ginger beard, he had a wild expression around his eyes and a hungry look that seemed to have been with him always. "I never saw him, but I thought of Lazarus," one declared. His shoulders twitched, and his hands were never still, always picking at something, twirling a button or fiddling with his whiskers. They had not fancied getting their first taste of combat under a man who had been sent home such a short while back under suspicion of insanity. 3 days before Grant's arrival, though at first their fears were intensified, they learned better. Smith sent them south for a try at breaking the vital Memphis and Charleston Railroad down across the Mississippi line. They came off the transports at midnight in a blinding rain. By daylight they were far inland, and still the rain came pouring. Bridges were washed out so that the cavalry, scouting ahead, lost men and horses, drowned while trying to ford the swollen creeks. Behind them the Tennessee was rising fast, threatening to cut them off by flooding the bottom they had marched across. At this point, just when things were at their worst, Sherman ordered them back to the transports. It had been a nightmare operation, and probably they had done no earthly good. They were wet, tired, hungry, cold. For the most part, they had been thoroughly frightened. But curiously enough, when they were back aboard the transports, drinking hot coffee and snuggling into blankets, they felt fine about the whole thing. They had been down into enemy country, the actual Deep South, a division on its own, looking for trouble. That gave them the feeling of being veterans. And they had seen their commander leading them. Sherman was not the same man at all. He was not nervous. His shoulders did not twitch. He was calm and confident, and when he saw the thing was impossible, he did not hesitate to give it up. Whatever else he might be, he certainly was not crazy. They knew that now, and they were willing to follow wherever he led them. Grant, too, had changed, the veterans saw when he came up to Pittsburgh to inspect them. Mostly it was the aura of fame that had been gathering around him in the month since the news from Donelson first set the church bells ringing. He was unconditional S. Grant now, and his picture was on the cover of Harper's Weekly. There was a hunger for particulars about him, for instance, how he generally stood or walked with his left hand in his trousers pocket and had in his mouth an unlighted cigar, the end of which he chewed restlessly. The cigar was an example of the change that stemmed from fame. Learning that he had kept one clamped in his teeth that critical afternoon at Donelson, whenever he was not using it like a marshal's baton to point the direction for attack, readers had sent him boxes of them to express their admiration. And since Grant had never been one to waste things, least of all good tobacco, the long-stemmed meerschaum that had given him so much satisfaction in the past was put away while he concentrated on smoking up those crates of gift cigars. One other change he had made on his own. His beard, which formerly had reached down past the second button on his coat, had been clipped short. It seemed to the soldiers, observing him now, a gesture not unlike that of a man rolling up his sleeves, in preparation for hard work. For him, work meant fighting. That was his trade, the only one he had ever been any good at or able to earn a living by, and he wanted to be at it right away. Restrained by Halleck, however, "We must strike no blow until we are strong enough to admit no doubt of the result," the department commander warned. All Grant could do now was prepare for the attack he would launch when Buell got there. Meanwhile, the position appeared to him to be about as good as Sherman had reported. 100-foot yellow clay bluff rose abruptly from the narrow shelf of the landing, where steamboats had unloaded peacetime cargoes for Corinth, to a plateau eroded by gullies and covered with second-growth timber, except for scattered clearings cut by farmers for orchards and grain fields. It was not quite a magnificent plain, but it did have points of military strength, the flanks being protected by Lick and Snake Creeks, which emptied into the Tennessee above and below the landing. The area between them, a quadrilateral varying roughly from 3 to 5 miles on a side, gave plenty of room for drilling the 5 divisions camped there, and was conveniently cross-hatched by a network of wagon trails leading inland and connecting the small farms. But Grant's primary interest was on the main road leading southwest to Corinth, one hard day's march away. That was the one he would take when the time came, meaning Buell. Halleck reported him nearing Waynesboro, 40 miles away, but cautioned Grant, "Don't let the enemy draw you into an engagement now. Wait till you are properly fortified and receive orders." This raised another question, for the position had not been fortified at all. Smith had already expressed an opinion on that. The crusty general had been put to bed with an infected leg, having skinned his shin on the sharp edge of a rowboat seat, but he was quite undaunted. "By God," he said, "I ask nothing better than to have the rebels come out and attack us. We can whip them to hell. Our men suppose we have come here to fight, and if we begin to spade, it will make them think we fear the enemy." Grant agreed and left things as they were, despite the warning. The war was on its last legs, he told Halleck, and the enemy too demoralized to constitute a danger. The temper of the rebel troops is such that there is but little doubt but that Corinth will fall much more easily than Donelson did when we do move. All accounts agree in saying that the great mass of the rank and file are heartily tired. One man, at least, did not agree at first, and that was Sherman. Privately, he was telling newsmen, "We are in great danger here." But when asked why he did not protest to those in charge, he shrugged, "Oh, they'd call me crazy again." As time went by, however, and no attack developed, he became as complacent as the rest. Before the end of March, he wrote gaily to an army friend in Cairo, "I hope we may meet in Memphis. Here we are on its latitude, and you have its longitude. Draw our parallels, and we breakfast at the Gayoso. Whither let us Godspeed, and then rejoice once more at the progress of our cause." Already there had been cause for rejoicing by some of his fellow generals, promotions having come through on the 21st for the 3 who commanded divisions at Donelson. Smith received his in bed. His leg was getting worse instead of better, but McClernand took his step up with the continuing belief that other advancements were in store, and Lew Wallace was now the youngest major general in the army. Smith's division was placed in charge of W.H.L. Wallace, an Ohio lawyer who had won his stars at Donelson. 2 of the 3 divisions added since were led by brigadiers who had moved to Illinois from the south and stood by the Union when trouble came. Benjamin M. Prentice, a Virginia-born merchant, and Stephen A. Hurlbut, a lawyer originally from Charleston, South Carolina. Sherman, commanding the remaining Green Division, had had less combat experience than any of them, none at all, in fact, since that grievous July afternoon on the banks of Bull Run in faraway Virginia, where McClellan, now that April was at hand, was boarding a steamer to go down the coast and join his army for an advance up the James Peninsula. But he was the only one of the 6 who was regular army, and Grant left the tactical arrangements in general to him, commuting daily by steamboat from the Savannah Mansion, 9 miles away. Between them, these six commanded 18 brigades, 74 regiments containing 42,682 soldiers, some raw, some hardened by combat. Green or seasoned, however, they approved to a man of their commander's intention to march down to Corinth as soon as Buell arrived with 30,000 more and administer another dose of the medicine they had forced down rebel throats the month before. Johnston had 16 brigades, 71 regiments, with a total strength of 40,335. But even apart from the day-to-day danger of Buell's reaching Pittsburgh Landing with three-fourths that many more, the present near equality in numbers was considerably offset by a contrasting lack of combat experience. Two-thirds of Grant's men had been in battle, in fact had been victorious in battle, whereas in Johnston's army, except for Forrest's troopers and the handful Polk had sent to Pillow's aid 5 months ago at Belmont, few had heard a shot fired in anger, and only Hardee's men had even done much real marching. Bragg referred to the forces around Corinth as "this mob we have, miscalled soldiers," and complained that a good part of them had never done a day's work in their lives. Johnston, of course, was aware of these shortcomings, but his scouts having kept him well informed, he counted much on the element of surprise. He knew what he would find up there, an army camped with its back to a deep river, unfortified, hemmed in by boggy creeks, disposed for comfort and scattered the peacetime way. Meanwhile, drill and instruction were repairing the Confederate flaws Bragg had pointed out so harshly. He would strike as soon as he felt it possible. The question was, how long would he have before Buell got there, or Grant saw the danger and corrected his dispositions, or worse, moved out and beat him to the punch? Late at night, April 2nd, a telegram from Bethel, 20 miles north on the M&O, seemed to Beauregard to confirm the last and worst of these fears. Lew Wallace was maneuvering in that direction. Taking this for the beginning of a full-scale attack on Memphis, he forwarded the message to Johnston after writing on the bottom, "Now is the moment to advance and strike the enemy at Pittsburgh Landing." Johnston read it, then crossed the street to confer with Bragg, who had been made chief of staff in addition to his other duties under last week's reorganization. Johnston wanted more time for drilling his army and awaiting the arrival of Van Dorn, but Bragg was insistent in support of Beauregard's endorsement. Whatever this latest development meant, Buell was drawing closer every day. It had to be now or never, he said, and Johnston at last agreed. Ready or unready, Van Dorn or no Van Dorn, they would go up to Pittsburgh and attack the Federal Army in its camp. Within an hour of the telegram's midnight arrival, orders went out for the four corps commanders to hold their commands in hand, ready to advance upon the enemy in the morning by 6 a.m., with 3 days' cooked rations in haversacks, 100 rounds of ammunition for small arms, and 200 rounds for field pieces. Early next morning, Beauregard's chief of staff got to work, preparing the march instructions from notes the general had made on scraps of paper during the night. As he worked, he had at his elbow Napoleon's Waterloo order, using it as a model despite the way that battle had turned out for the one who planned it. Since this would require considerable time, first the writing, then the copying and the distribution, Beauregard called Hardee and Bragg to his room to explain the march routes verbally. Their corps would lead the way, and the written instructions could be delivered after they got started. As he spoke, he drew a crude map on the top of a camp table, indicating distances and directions. Two roads ran from Corinth up to Pittsburgh. On the map, they resembled a strung bow leaned sideways, curved side up, with the two armies at the top and bottom tips. The lower route through Monterey was the string. The upper route through Mickey's was the bow. Bragg and Breckinridge were to travel the string, Hardee and Polk the bow, in that order. Hardee was to reach Mickey's that night, bivouac, then at 3 a.m. pass on and form for battle in the fields beyond. Polk was to wait while Bragg marched up the road from Monterey and cleared the junction at Mickey's, then follow him into position, clearing the way for Breckinridge in turn. They were to regulate their columns so as not to delay each other, keeping their files well closed and the various elements properly spaced. So much for the march order, the battle order followed. Beyond Mickey's, within charging distance of the enemy outposts, they were to form for battle in successive lines. Hardee across the front with one brigade from Bragg, who was to form a second line 500 yards in rear. Polk and Breckinridge were to mass their corps to the left and right, a half mile behind Bragg, so that when he went forward, following Hardee, Polk could spread out wide in his support, leaving Breckinridge in column as the general reserve. The flanks of the army, with the three lead corps extending individually across the entire front, rested on the creeks that hemmed Grant in. As they advanced, each line would thus support the one in front, and the reserve corps would feed troops from the rear toward those points where resistance turned out stiffest. The attack on the right was intended to move fastest, bearing generally left in a long curve, first along the watershed of Lick Creek and then down the west bank of the Tennessee, so as to sweep the Federals clear of the landing and drive them back against the boggy northward loop of Snake Creek, where they could be destroyed. Today was Thursday, April 3rd. According to schedule, the troops would complete the 20-mile approach march and be deployed for battle no later than mid-morning tomorrow. But when the council broke up at 10 o'clock, already 4 hours past the starting time, and the generals dispersed to get their columns on the road, troops and wagons quickly snarled to a standstill, blocking the streets of Corinth. Polk at last got clear of the jam, but had to wait while Hardee doubled his column and took the lead. By then it was late afternoon, and Polk was held up till after sunset. When he stopped for the night, he had covered a scant 9 miles. Down on the lower road, Bragg's unwieldy column did no better. Manifestly, the schedule would have to be revised. Beauregard set it forward a whole day, intending now to be deployed in time to strike the Federals early Saturday morning. But if Thursday had been like a bad dream, Friday was a nightmare. The march, which had seemed so easy to regulate on the flat, uncluttered tabletop, turned out to be something quite different on the ground, which was neither flat nor uncluttered, nor, as it turned out, dry. The abrupt, thunderous showers of a Mississippi April broke over the winding column, and soon the wagon and artillery wheels had churned the roads into shin-deep mud. There were halts and unaccountable delays, times when the men had to trot to keep up, and times when they stood endlessly in the rain, waiting for the file ahead to stumble into motion. In their wake, the roadsides were littered with discarded equipment, overcoats and playing cards, bowie knives and Bibles. A more welcome delay was the rest halt given each regiment while its colonel read the commanding general's address, written in Corinth while they were assembling for the march. "Soldiers of the Army of the Mississippi, I have put you in motion to offer battle to the invaders of your country, with the resolution and disciplined valor becoming men fighting as you are for all worth living or dying for. You can but march to a decisive victory over the agrarian mercenaries sent to subjugate and despoil you of your liberties, property, and honor. Remember the precious stake involved. Remember the dependence of your mothers, your wives, your sisters, and your children on the result. Remember the fair, broad, abounding land, the happy homes, and the ties that would be desolated by your defeat. The eyes and hopes of 8 millions of people rest upon you. You are expected to show yourselves worthy of your race and lineage, worthy of the women of the South, whose noble devotion in this war has never been exceeded in any time. With such incentives to brave deeds, and with the trust that God is with us, your generals will lead you confidently to the combat, assured of success. A.S. Johnston, General." It was delivered in various styles, ranging from the oratorical with flourishes to the matter-of-fact, depending on the previous civil occupation of the reader. The troops cheered wildly or perfunctorily, depending on their degree of weariness and in part on how the address was read, then fell back into column on the muddy roads for more of the stop-and-go marching. But the one who had it worst that day was Bragg. He, too, had made a late start out of Corinth, and the head of his oversized column did not reach Monterey, where it should have bivouacked the night before, until near midday. One of his divisions was lost somewhere in the rear, perhaps sidetracked, and he had had no word from Breckinridge at all. As a result, though Hardee and Polk were marching hard to make up for yesterday's wasted time, the latter was held up short of Mickey's, waiting for Bragg to clear the junction, and the former had no sooner got past it than he received a message asking him to call a halt so that Bragg's dragging column could close the expanding gap. Bragg was a tall, gangling man, a West Pointer and a Mexican war hero. "A little more grape, Captain Bragg," Zachary Taylor was supposed to have told him at Buena Vista, as every schoolboy knew, though what he really said was, "Captain, give 'em hell." A native North Carolinian, lately a Louisiana sugar planter, in his middle 40s but looking 10 years older because of chronic stomach trouble and a coarse gray-black beard which emphasized his heaviness of jaw and sternness of aspect. Not that the latter needed emphasis, already having been rendered downright ferocious by the thick bushy eyebrows which grew in a continuous line across the bottom of his forehead. It galled him to have to send that message to Hardee, amounting as it did to an admission of being to blame for the delay, for he was a strict disciplinarian, and like most such, he was quick to lose his temper when things went wrong. Still jammed on the roads leading into and out of Mickey's, when they should have been moving into the final position where they would deploy for the attack tomorrow morning, the weary and bedraggled troops were caught that night in the same thunderstorm that attended the Carondelet on her run past Island 10, just over 100 miles away. All semblance of order dissolved under torrents of rain. When Johnston and Beauregard rode into Mickey's soon after sunrise, expecting to find the army arrayed for combat, they had left Corinth the day before and spent the night at Monterey. The rain had stopped and the sun was shining bright on the flooded fields, but the army was far from arrayed. In fact, most of it had not even arrived. Hardee was approximately in position, but he was waiting for the brigade from Bragg that would complete his line. By the time it got there, the sun was already high in the sky, and Beauregard was fuming. He had cause. As they marched forward to file into line, the men began to worry about the dampness of the powder in their rifles. But instead of drawing the charges and reloading, they tested them by snapping the triggers, with the result that within earshot of the Federal outposts, there was an intermittent banging up and down the columns, as rackety as a sizable picket clash. Nor was that all. The returning sun having raised their spirits, the men began to tune up their rebel yells and practice marksmanship on birds and rabbits. For 2 hours, then, with Johnston and Beauregard standing by, Bragg continued to deploy the remainder of his corps, all but the rear division, which still had not arrived. When Johnston asked where it was, the harassed Bragg replied that it was somewhere back there. He was trying to locate it. Johnston waited, his impatience mounting, then took out his watch. 12:30. "This is perfectly puerile. This is not war," he exclaimed, and set off down the road himself to look for the missing division. He found it wedged behind some of Polk's troops, who had not been willing to yield the right of way. The daylight hours were going fast. By the time Johnston got the road cleared and the last of Bragg's men passed to the front, his watch showed 2 o'clock. Polk's deployment used up another 2 hours, and Breckinridge, who had come up at last, was still to be brought forward. The shadows were getting longer every minute. It was not until about 4:30, however, that Johnston received the worst shock of all. Riding forward, he came upon a roadside conference between Beauregard and Polk and Bragg. The Creole's big, sad bloodhound eyes were rimmed with angry red, and his hands were fluttering as he spoke. He was upset, which was understandable, for it was already 10 hours past the time when he expected to launch the attack. He favored canceling the whole movement and returning at once to Corinth. In his mind, surprise was everything, and what with the delay piled on the previous postponement, the constant tramping back and forth, and the racket the men had been making, all chance for surprise had been forfeited. He knew this, he said, because at one point that afternoon he had heard a drum rolling, but when he sent to have it silenced, the messenger came back and reported that it could not be done. The drum was in the Union camp. Beauregard reasoned that if he could hear enemy drum taps, there was small doubt that the Federals had heard the random firing and whooping in the Confederate columns. Besides, 10 Southern troopers had been captured in a cavalry clash the night before. Surely by now they had been questioned, and one at least had talked. "There is no chance for surprise," he ended angrily. "Now they will be entrenched to the eyes." Johnston heard him out, then turned to Polk, his West Point roommate. The bishop disagreed. His troops were eager for battle. They had left Corinth on the way to a fight, he said in that deep pulpit voice of his, and if they did not find one, they would be as demoralized as if they had been whipped. Bragg said he felt the same way about it. While he was speaking, Breckinridge rode up. Surprised that withdrawal was even being considered, he sided with Polk and Bragg, declaring that he would as soon be defeated as retire without a fight.